Last week, we started looking into the relationship between religion and prosperity. Dean Carlin, an economist at Northwestern, told us about his work with Innovations for Poverty Action,
which is a nonprofit organization which helps do research to figure out what works and what doesn't to fight poverty and social problems around the world.
Carlin recently teamed up with David Sutherland, the chairman of a Christian missionary organization called International Care Ministries, or ICM.
We can find the poorest people, and we can reach them very, very efficiently.
We also spoke with James Choi, a finance professor at Yale, who collaborates with Dean Carlin. He told us how hard it is to get meaningful data on the economic impact of religion.
Yeah, so laboratory tasks, no matter how cleverly designed they are, no matter how compelling they are, at the end of the day, that's not real life.
So with the cooperation of International Care Ministries, Choi and Carlin set out to investigate some bold claims about the benefits of religion.
People where religion is a bigger part of their life tend to drink less, do fewer drugs, live longer, report higher levels of happiness, do less crime, things of this nature. So lots of correlations.
This week, we'll hear what they learned.
That's food. That's food on the table. And this is a household that has children going to bed hungry.
And we'll explore perhaps the most famous theory about the relationship between religion and prosperity, the Protestant work ethic.
This was one of the most influential theses in the social sciences, but also one of the most controversial ones.
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The fact that economics doesn't really have an answer about the effects of religion is pretty remarkable when you consider that roughly 8 out of 10 people on the planet identify themselves as religious. The three largest denominations are Christianity, with around 31%, Islam, 23%, and Hinduism, 15%. Christianity is most concentrated in the Americas, Europe, and sub-Saharan Africa. The Middle East and North Africa, meanwhile, are 93% Muslim, while the Asia-Pacific region is the most variegated. Just 7% Christian, with 24% Muslim, 25% Hindu, 12% Buddhist, 9% belonging to folk religions, and 21% unaffiliated. Jews, in case you're wondering, make up 0.2% of the global population. And what about James Choi?
Yes, I do consider myself religious. I identify as an evangelical Protestant.
Academia, as you likely know, is not exactly a hotbed of religious sentiment. Even so, Choi has never been shy about his own beliefs.
If you think that what you believe matters for where you're going to go for the rest of eternity, then, you know, why wouldn't you want to share that with other people?
On his Yale faculty website, Choi has a page that reads, "Why I am a Christian, even though I don't believe in Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, or the Tooth Fairy."
And actually, that post is part of the reason why we ended up working together.
Dean Carlin again. He was raised Jewish, now considers himself agnostic. Back when he was on the Yale faculty with James Choi, he'd seen that Easter Bunny page.
And so one night at dinner, I brought it up.
And so what we were talking about was, how might we identify the effect of religion?
And so we started brainstorming about how to actually test this.
And we had kind of this crazy idea that we would find some missionary organization that went out and evangelized to rural villages that were all isolated from each other, and we would try to convince this missionary organization to randomize which villages they went to and which villages they didn't go to. And so, of course, this is crazy talk, and so this idea went nowhere.
It went nowhere until a few years later, when Carlin had that breakfast in Hong Kong with David Sutherland.
And then Dean excitedly contacted me and said, you know, I found just the organization that can do this, and this is International Care Ministries. And they are a very data-driven organization, and they care about whether their programs are actually helping people. And so they were willing to randomly assign which villages ended up getting different versions of their programs.
Okay, here is how ICM's Transform program typically works. The participants, most of them women and self-identified as Catholic, and all of them excruciatingly poor. They'd meet once a week for roughly 4 months. The meetings were usually held in a church building, but again, even the ICM pastors have very little money. The building might have a dirt floor, a scrap roof, no electricity.
So every meeting is 90 minutes long, 30 minutes of values, 30 minutes of health, 30 minutes of livelihood, VHL.
David Sutherland again.
So we train the pastor to teach the values curriculum, the spiritual part of the curriculum, and they get 30 minutes each week. We teach them about the love of God, respect for biblical principles, how Christ can help you to solve your day-to-day problems.
And then there are the two non-religious components of the program, health instruction.
We will have our own person, an ICM employee that we train as a health trainer.
They're taught ideas about hygiene, nutrition, provided nutritional supplements for children.
And the livelihood portion.
And we have our own livelihood person trained by ICM.
The term livelihood in this context refers to kind of economic activity.
We show them how to do organic gardening, which is very low cash. And then a few weeks later, you can have vegetables to feed your kids.
There's lessons about small business enterprises, how to get that started. A small grant often goes with that. They also form a savings group. So there's a financial inclusion aspect to the program.
So that's the typical 90-minute weekly meeting. One-third economic livelihood, one-third health and nutrition, one-third religious instruction. David Sutherland and ICM suspected the program was helpful long-term, but was it helpful because of the religious values? That is what Dean Carlin, James Choi, and a third economist, Garrett Bryan, set out to learn. The first step in a randomized controlled trial is to randomize. They started by recruiting 160 pastors affiliated with ICM and having each pastor identify two Philippine villages where they'd never worked. And in each of those two villages,
we had the pastors go out and pick out who they believed to be the 30 poorest families in each of these communities. And then we randomly assigned which community the pastor would be ministering to.
So they would flip a coin about which village they actually went and worked in. And then we used the other one as the comparison. So we had four different treatment arms to the study. We had one treatment arm that received the full package.
The full package, meaning the standard transform curriculum, equal parts religious values, health and nutrition, and economic livelihood.
For another quarter of the villages, just the pastor went, not the ICM employees.
So those participants got only the values or religious instruction.
For another quarter of the villages, just the ICM employees went, and the pastor never showed up.
And so in those villages, people were receiving just a secular curriculum and did not receive a Christian curriculum.
In these cases, the program was not held in a church, just to make sure the religious component was totally removed.
And then a quarter of the villages, there's nothing. They're left as is.
So that was the control group?
Okay, so those were the four conditions from a set of villages that had been chosen randomly, with each condition including hundreds of households. It's pretty impressive for a real-world RCT. 6 months later, the economists went back to measure the results. Now, how do you do that?
Yeah, so we wanted the study to be about the effect of religiosity on economic outcomes.
We ended up working with 6,000 households.
So in order to identify the effect of religiosity, we were comparing those who got values, health, livelihoods against those who got just health and livelihoods. And then we also compared those who got just values against those who got nothing.
This would allow them to isolate the economic and other effects of the religious instruction. But first, they'd need to know whether the religious instruction actually increased religiosity.
Our study would kind of go nowhere if the religious curriculum didn't actually change the religiosity of the individuals attending these classes.
They surveyed people to see if the program made them more likely to read the Bible, pray, or attend religious services.
And we found that it did.
So we found big increases in religious behavior.
So then we can go to the second stage, which is given that the religious programs increased religiosity, what does the effect downstream on other economic outcomes seem to be?
They looked at everything from food security to life satisfaction to, of course, income. Because the whole purpose of this project, the whole purpose of the ICM charity, was to alleviate poverty. So what was the biggest downstream effect, as they call it, of just the religious instruction?
What we found was that just being exposed to the religious curriculum increased income by 9% relative to the control group.
And that's actually pretty noticeable. That's food. That's food on the table. And this is a household that has children going to bed hungry.
So that's pretty interesting. A 9% increase in household income that seems to be caused by religiosity. Okay, so that's the what. But what's the why? In this kind of research, the what is usually far easier to answer than the why. But why do we think religiosity might drive income? Dean Carlin, James Choi, and David Sutherland each have their own ideas, which, to my ear at least, seem to reflect their own perspectives on religion. First, we'll hear from Sutherland, the man behind this religious charity.
Those people live such depressing, fatalistic lives that that they don't take advantage of opportunities that are available to them. If we can inject hope into those people's lives, then life can change.
And James Choi, the unabashedly religious economist.
I think that it really probably has to do with the fact that they're told that they have worth in God's eyes and their suffering has meaning. And therefore, they can continue on and they can pick themselves up after they experience setbacks. And that's tremendously encouraging. And it allows them to engage in more productive economic behavior.
And finally, the agnostic, Dean Carlin.
I am very interested in understanding more about issues on hope and aspiration and kind of drive and ambition. And what is it that makes it so that some ultra-poor households later are doing better and others are not? And some of that is bad luck, but some of that is about taking opportunities and seizing them and running with them.
Carlin and Choi did turn up some data that addresses the why question to understand why religiosity might lead to higher income.
Yeah, so I think that there were two potential channels that stood out.
One is that we see optimism increase.
And second, we found that their grit increased.
Grit is a direct measure of kind of work ethic. Do you always finish tasks? And this is exactly what we're talking about when we talk about, you know, the Protestant work ethic.
Ah, the old Protestant work ethic. That idea has been around for a long time. What is it exactly? Where'd it come from? And how strong is the evidence that it's real?
So how can we attribute this difference in prosperity to religion rather than some other, perhaps unmeasured factor?
Coming up after the break, we'll tell you about the ingenious research project that answers these questions about the Protestant work ethic. We'll be right back. Freakonomics Radio is supported by the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting progress in education, science, and the arts. Information at cysimsfoundation.org.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Indeed. With Indeed, employers can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on a short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Learn more at indeed.com/hire.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The randomized controlled trial of a missionary project in the Philippines found that very poor people earned more money as a result of receiving religious instruction. Why? The researchers suspect there were two primary drivers: optimism and grit. The economist Dean Carlin again.
And this is exactly what we're talking about when we talk about the Protestant work ethic.
The idea goes back to the early 20th century, when the pioneering social scientist Max Weber wrote a long essay called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism.
And this was one of the most influential theses in the social sciences, but also one of the most controversial ones.
That's George Spencook.
And I'm an assistant professor at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University.
Spencook, like Weber, was born and raised in Germany.
I would describe myself as agnostic, though I did grow up in a Catholic household. My parents go to church regularly.
As a grad student in the U.S., Spencook got interested in Weber's famous theory.
Basically, he argued that the Protestant doctrine of self-determination would make people work harder. My question was whether Weber was right, whether there is a causal effect of Protestantism.
To answer this question, we need to go back to 16th century Germany. A young Catholic priest named Martin Luther had grown disgusted by many church practices, especially the sale of indulgences, that is, the forgiving of sins in exchange for large donations.
And initially he wanted to reform the church from within. But when he met resistance and was persecuted by church authorities, he decided to break off. And at the time, the printing press had just been invented. So he essentially launched what we call today a large-scale media campaign.
Luther also launched what came to be known as the Protestant Reformation. It would play out all across Europe for decades, with brutal wars between reformers and church loyalists, with millions of deaths. On the religious front, meanwhile,
his teachings became what's now the Lutheran faith.
Luther's teachings departed from Catholicism in several important ways, including a new conception of work.
So the medieval church, Catholicism, said if you really want to be religious and really please God, you need to go into the monastery.
That's Tim Keller, a theologian and the founding pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York.
The Reformation changed that completely. Martin Luther comes along and says, look at all the places in the Bible where it says that God feeds every living thing. He says, well, how is God feeding every living thing? Is food just appearing on their table? No. He says, obviously, God is feeding every living thing through human labor. So even the humblest farmer's daughter who is milking a cow is actually doing God's work. And therefore, he said, all work is a calling. All work is doing God's work.
And so it came to be that centuries later, Max Weber would argue that Protestantism helped fuel the rise of capitalism, in part by reframing secular work as a religious expression. Weber also argued that discipline played a strong role, that Protestantism tried to instill the discipline of the Catholic clergy into the Protestant laity. Keller again.
Catholicism basically said the religious orders, the monks and the nuns, they had to live a very disciplined life, but the hoi polloi, the masses, can kind of be out there and doing what they want to do. Protestants came along and it put a lot of emphasis on all Christians have got to live virtuous, disciplined lives, all Christians. And that created a basis for thrift and self-control.
Some scholars have attacked Weber's thesis on empirical grounds. For instance, the very Catholic Northern Italy saw the inklings of capitalist enterprise well before the Protestant Reformation. And while it's true that even today, Protestant countries tend to be more prosperous than Catholic ones, there is the old correlation does not mean causality problem.
Yes, the Netherlands and Great Britain are more Protestant than, say, Spain or Italy. But they also speak different languages, they have different cultures apart from religion, and there are many other things that vary. So how can we attribute this difference in prosperity to religion rather than some other, perhaps unmeasured factor?
That was exactly the question that George Spencook wanted to answer.
Whether there is a causal effect of Protestantism.
But if you think about how hard it was for Dean Carlin and James Choi to learn whether religious instruction helped Filipino villagers earn more money, how was Spencook supposed to learn whether a 500-year-old religious transformation had an economic impact that could still be felt today? Well, it started with a simple idea. Remember, the Protestant Reformation triggered wars throughout Europe. Germany, at the time, was made up of more than 1,000 independent territories, each ruled by its own lord or prince.
And what settled these wars was the Peace of Augsburg in 1555. And that peace treaty gave local rulers and, you know, lords the right to determine the religion of their territory, and therefore the religion of all people who lived on that territory. And you have to realize that these were times of indentured servitude. So if my lord converted to Protestantism, that meant I also converted to Protestantism.
And if your lord stayed Catholic, so did you. But if a Catholic family lived in a territory where the local prince chose Protestantism, they could freely migrate to a Catholic area and vice versa. This created throughout Germany a checkerboard of Protestant and Catholic micropopulations. And George Spencook noticed something.
What I noticed was that if you overlay a map from 1555 with a map from modern-day Germany and compare the geographic distribution of Protestants and Catholics, they almost match exactly, meaning that whichever way a prince decided in the aftermath of the peace has a huge impact on how many Protestants live in the same area today.
Spencook realized he could exploit this demographic accident of history.
So I used that to determine the effect of Protestantism on modern-day economic outcomes.
Modern Germany is about one-third Protestant, one-third Catholic, and one-third non-religious. The Protestant and Catholic populations, beyond religion itself, are quite similar. And Germany being Germany, there was a lot of data available for Spencook to drill down further.
So we can do better than just looking at, are Protestants richer than Catholics? We can ask, are they more educated than Catholics? Or do they work longer hour than Catholics? Do they want to work longer hour than Catholics, etc.?
With these data in hand, Spencook could now control for any differences beyond religious affiliation, which let him compare apples to apples, or really to compare observationally equivalent modern German Protestants and German Catholics to see who earns more money and perhaps why. So what did he find?
I find three things. One, yes, Protestantism increases labor income in modern-day Germany. Two, Protestants work longer hours than Catholics. And three, they don't earn higher wages. Meaning it's like, yes, Protestants are a little bit more prosperous, but because they work more.
In other words, the Protestant work ethic does seem to be real. So again, that's the what. As for the why?
So this is where the data gets very thin. So what I do find in the data that when you ask people, how many hours a week would you want to work conditional on your income adjusting accordingly, Protestants would want to work longer hours. But what drives these differences, sort of if you dig a layer deeper, I don't know.
In any case, George Spencook's evidence for the Protestant work ethic, at least in the context of modern Germany, is pretty persuasive. We should say this is not necessarily an economic argument for conversion. Reverend Keller again.
If a person is Catholic living in America today and becomes a Protestant, does that mean that person is going to make more money, work harder? I doubt it.
And several downsides of Protestantism have been measured. One recent study found that Protestants in 19th century Germany were substantially more likely than Catholics to die by suicide. George Spencook recently published a paper about another troubling association with Protestantism in Germany.
The 10-second summary is that religion is the single most important determinant of Nazi vote shares at the end of the Weimar Republic. Protestants at the time were 2 to 4 times as likely as equivalent Catholics to vote for the Nazi Party. Now, why was that? In the paper, we argued that that's due to the Catholic Church's influence over parishioners.
It's worth noting that what Spencook observed about incomes in Germany being driven by working more hours does not seem to account for the income gains that Dean Carlin and James Choi observed in the Philippines.
We don't see an increase in the number of hours that people work, but we do see important changes in what they're doing.
They seem to shift away from agricultural work towards other kinds of work, which may be more high-paying, and so that may be kind of just the accounting channel through which their income is increasing.
There are, of course, a lot of differences between the Germans that Spencook studied and the Filipinos that Choi and Carlin studied, especially the fact that the Filipinos were punishingly poor and perhaps had quicker gains to make by trying a different kind of work than what they'd been doing. It's also possible they were already working about as many hours as humanly possible. David Sutherland, the ex-Morgan Stanley CFO who runs the Philippines charity, thinks the religious instruction works for a very basic reason.
I think reorients their whole life, and it changes their approach to how they decide what they're going to do the next day.
As devout as Sutherland is personally, he's not sure the Protestant work ethic is really the key.
Hey, I'm a true believer, right? So for sure, I would like to say that the Protestant relationship with God is a unique differentiator. Now, could someone with a Buddhist background or a Hindu background or a Muslim background that engaged with God the way they understood it, and if that really injected hope in their life, that clearly would have a important change for them. But whether it's the same as the Protestant, that's really hard for me to say. I don't know. I think that additional study would be needed to know whether that's true.
This is something that everyone we've spoken with today has in common. It may be useful to have learned a few things about the relationship between religion and income. There is much, much more that isn't yet known.
At the end of the day, you know, we have not answered the question, what is the impact of religion? No one study is ever going to do that.
We don't have the data to answer that definitively, and so basically we're left to speculate.
I wish I knew the answer.
So for those of you listening who are religious, and for those who aren't, here's to questions asked, questions answered, and even those that remain unanswerable. It's nice to live in a world that's still got a little mystery, don't you think? Coming up after the break, if you work in an office, there's a good chance it's an open office, at least to some degree. And you love your open office, don't you?
I was contacted by a number of friends about their open offices and their deep, deep emotional scarring.
And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Stitcher or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Indeed. With Indeed, employers can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on a short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire. Freakonomics Radio is supported by LegalZoom, dedicated to helping small business owners get started by providing wills and trusts, LLCs, trademarks, and more. Information is available at LegalZoom.com/Freakonomics.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hey, are you at work right now? And do you work in an office? Have you ever worked in an office? If you have, there's a good chance it was an open office, at least to some degree. The open office design has been around for decades in a variety of forms. If you are a cynic, you might think an open office is all about cramming the maximum number of employees into the minimum amount of real estate. But you could also imagine that an open office produces better interaction and more collaboration. Wouldn't it be nice to know if this were true? That's what these people wanted to learn.
I'm Ethan Bernstein. I'm an associate professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School.
My name is Stephen Turbin. I am a recent graduate of Harvard College, and I currently work for a global management consultancy.
Okay, so we're here to talk about a paper that you co-authored called The Impact of the Open Workspace on Human Collaboration.
I don't think I realized how much anger there was against open offices until the research was published and I was contacted by a number of friends and colleagues about their open offices and their deep, deep emotional scarring.
There's certainly a population of people out there who hate. I think that's perhaps even not strong enough of a word.
Not strong enough,
hate.
Agree. But proceed, please.
It's just people find it impossible to get work done. They find it demoralizing.
Also, the lack of privacy and the feeling that they're being watched by others.
Privacy tends to give us license to be more experimental, to potentially find opportunities for continuous improvement, to avoid distractions that might take us away from the focus we have on our work.
Ethan is really, I would say, the king of privacy.
My research over time has been about the increasingly transparent workplace and its impact on human behavior and therefore performance. I've, over time, and ask the question, what about the open office? How does it impact the way in which people work and collaborate? I haven't had an empirical answer.
In search of an empirical answer, Bernstein and Turbin began a study of two Fortune 500 companies that were converting from cubicles to open offices.
If you're looking purely at a cost per square foot, having an open office is cheaper.
There are a lot of people, whether they're managers or employees, who like the open office.
Bernstein admits that managers are primarily impressed by the cost savings of an open office, but Some employees
like it because they have visions of it being more vibrant, more interactive, that fun, noisy, experiential place they're hoping for once you take down the walls and make everyone able to see each other.
And there's also been a big push around these collisions that have emerged in social sciences. How do you create these random interactions between people that spark creativity?
Collision is a term you hear a lot in office design and the design of public spaces generally. It's the promise that unplanned encounters can lead to good things between coworkers or neighbors, even strangers. Conversations that otherwise wouldn't have happened. The exchange of ideas, unforeseen collaboration. Now, the office is plainly a different sort of space from the public square. The office is primarily concerned with productivity. We'd all like to be happy working in our offices, but is it maybe worth surrendering a bit of happiness and privacy and so on for the sake of higher productivity? After all, that's what we're being paid for.
If you want to have a certain kind of interaction that's deep, productive in idea generation or in something that requires us to have lots of quote-unquote bandwidth between each other, it's nice to have that face-to-face interaction.
Nuanced communication around, here's a proposal I have, here is a thought I have about how this last meeting went. That is a very rich and nuanced form of communication. And most of the literature suggests that face-to-face communication is much better at that.
Sociologists have suggested for a long time that propinquity breeds interaction. Propinquity being co-location, being close to one another.
The closer two people are together, the more likely they are to interact, the more likely they are to get married, the more likely they are to work together.
And interaction being, we will have a conversation. We will actually get some kind of collaboration done between the two of us.
You can look at slouching shoulders. You can see, what is their facial expression? And that conveys a lot of information that is really hard to convey, no matter how good you are at emojis. And let me tell you, I am pretty good at emojis.
Okay, so face-to-face communication is important, at least for some purposes and on some dimensions. And an open office is designed to facilitate more face-to-face communication. So, does it work? That was the central question of Bernstein and Turbin's study. So, in your study, there are two companies that were transitioning two open offices. First of all, can you reveal the identity of one or both of those companies?
I can't. In order to do this study, we had to agree to a level of confidentiality. I will say that we had a choice of sites to study, and we chose the two that we thought would be most representative of the kind of work we were interested in, which is white-collar work in professional settings, Fortune 500 companies.
Can you give us some detail that helps us envision the kind of office and what the activities are?
If you work in a global headquarters amongst a series of functions like HR or finance or legal or sales or marketing, this would describe your work setting.
And can you describe, for the two companies that you studied, they moved to open offices. What was their configuration beforehand?
Everyone was in cubicles, and then they moved to an open space that basically mimicked that, but just without the cubicle walls.
Those barriers went down, and so you could see if John was sitting next to Sally before, and there was a wall between them. You know, John could see Sally, and Sally could see John, and that was the big difference between the original and the office afterwards.
So tell us about the experiment. I want to know all kinds of things like how many people were involved, did they opt in or not, was it randomized, and how the data were gathered, and so on.
In the first study, we had 52 participants. In our second, we had 100 participants. And we wanted to measure communication before and after the move.
We started with the most simple empirical puzzle we could start with, which was simply how much interaction takes place between the individuals before and after. We wanted to purely see if this hypothesis of a vibrant open office were true.
So before the move, we gave each of the participants sociometric badges.
So they contain several sensors. One is a microphone, one is an IR sensor to show whether or not they're facing another badge. They have an accelerometer to show movement, and they have a Bluetooth sensor to show location.
So you can get a data point which looks like, you know, John again spoke with Sally for 25 minutes at 2 p.m., but you don't know anything about what the content of the conversation is.
The number of previous studies that have used these sociometric badges have shown that we are very aware of them for the first, say, few minutes that we have them on. And after that, we sort of forget they're there.
You write that the microphone is only registering that people talk and not recording or monitoring what they say. Do you think the employees who wore them believe that? I mean, if I think there's a 1% chance that my firm is monitoring or recording what I'm saying, I'm quite likely to say less, yes?
Well, it's actually a kind of a funny question, because in this case, we really weren't. But look, we phrased the consent form as strongly as we could to ensure that they understood this was for research purposes. And if they hadn't believed us, they probably would have opted out.
What are we to make of the fact that the data represents the people who opted in only? Because I'm just running this through my head. If I were an employee and I'm told that there's some kind of experiment going on with these smart people from Harvard Business School, and however much you tell me or don't, I intuit some, or I figure out some, or I guess some, and we're moving to an open office, and I think, ooh, man, I hate the open office, and therefore, I definitely want to participate in this experiment so that I can sabotage it by behaving exactly the opposite of what I think they want me to behave. Is that too skeptical or cynical?
Boy, you sound like one of my reviewers in the peer review process.
Sorry.
It is a valid concern. Let me tell you what we've tried to do to alleviate it. The first thing I should say is we've compared the individuals who opted in to wearing the badge and those who did not to a series of demographics we got from the HR systems, and we don't see systematic differences there.
You know, it is always possible when you're doing social science research that someone makes a guess, whether it's accurate or not, about what the study is trying to understand, and then takes a personal stand and says, you know, I'm going to stand for what's right. And what's right is cubicles. In that case, they would have to have done that for every day for 2 months. So it would have been a remarkable feat of endurance. We don't think that that's what happened, but, you know, the open office factions are real. So definitely important to keep in mind.
In addition to all these data from the employees' badges, the researchers could also measure each employee's electronic communications, their emails and instant messages. Again, they were only measuring this communication, not examining the content.
And so what we were able to do is compare individuals face-to-face and electronic communication before and after the move from cubicles to open spaces in these two environments.
Okay, so you've done the study, two firms, over a period of time with a number of people to measure how their behavior changes generally. Tell us what you found.
So the study had two main conclusions.
We found that when these individuals moved from closed cubicles into the open office, interaction decreased.
Face-to-face communication decreased by about 70% in both of our two studies. Conversely, that communication wasn't entirely lost. The second result that we found was that communication actually increased virtually. So people emailed more, IM'd more.
How much of that decrease was compensated by electronic?
So we saw an increase of 20 to 50% of electronic communication. That means more emails, more IMs. And depending on how you think about what an email is worth, maybe you could say that they made up for it. Is an email worth 5 minutes of conversation? Is it 2 minutes?
It's a little bit hard to say because an email and an interaction may not be comparable in item.
Even if we saw an increase in the amount of virtual communication, which totally made up for the face-to-face communication, what you probably saw was a loss in richness communication. So the amount of information that was being conveyed was actually less.
What can you tell us about how the open space affected productivity and satisfaction?
I'll come out clean and say we don't have perfect data on performance, and we don't have any data on satisfaction. We purposefully stayed away from satisfaction. We just wanted to look at the interaction of individuals. In one of our two studies, we have anecdotally some information where the organization felt that actually performance had declined as a result of this move. I will say that, boy, if we think about this, there are probably lots of contexts that we can think of where more face-to-face interaction would be useful, and lots of contexts in which we think more face-to-face interaction would not be useful. And that's where I'd actually prefer to take the conversation about productivity. That at the very least, to date, managers of property, managers of organizations have not thought about this being a trade-off. They've assumed cost and revenue go together. That may be true in some subset of environments, but in others, that's not going to be true.
What did the companies in your study do after you'd presented them with your findings?
One of them has actually taken a step back from the open office. The other has attempted to make the open office work by adding more closed spaces to it.
Okay. So an empirical study of open offices finds that the primary benefit they are meant to confer, more face-to-face communication and the good things such communication can lead to, that it actually moves in the opposite direction, at least in the aggregate. To be fair, an open office is bound to be much better for certain tasks than others, and more important, better for some people than others. We're not all the same. And some of us, I'm told, not me, but some of us thrive in a potentially chattier office. But on balance, it would appear that being put out in the open leads most people to close themselves off a bit. Why? You can probably answer that question for yourself, but Turbin and Bernstein have some thoughts too. Here's one. Maybe you don't want to disturb other people.
So when you're in open office, your voice carries. And I think people decide very reasonably to say, well, you know, I could speak with Tammy, who's three desks away. But if I talk to Tammy, I'm going to disrupt Larry and Catherine. And so I will send her a quick message instead.
Or maybe you compensate for the openness of the open office with behavior that sends a do not disturb signal.
If everyone can see you, you want to signal to everyone that you are a hard worker. So you look intensely at your screen. Maybe you put on headphones to block the noise. Guess what? When we signal that, we also tend to signal, and please don't interrupt me from my work, which may very well have been part of what happened in our studies here.
And then there's what Ethan Bernstein calls the transparency paradox.
So very simply, the transparency paradox is the idea that increasingly transparent open, observable workplaces can create less transparent employees.
For instance, let's say you've been really productive all morning. Now you want to take a break. You want to check your fantasy football lineup. Maybe you want to look up some recipes for dinner. But you don't want everyone in the office, especially your boss, to see what you're doing. So you do it anyway, but you're constantly looking over your shoulder in case you need to shut down the fantasy football or recipe tabs.
That has implications for productivity because we spend time on it. We spend energy on it. We spend effort on it. We tend to believe these days that we get our best work done when we can be our authentic selves. Very few of us get up on a stage in front of a large audience, which is somewhat of how some people encounter the open office and feel we can be our authentic selves.
So if I have an idea...
That is the Stanford economist Nicholas Bloom.
If I, you know, go discuss it with my colleague or my manager in an open office, I'm terrified that, you know, other people will hear, they may pass judgment on me, rumors can go around.
Bloom has studied this realm for years.
I work a lot on firms and productivity, so what makes some firms more productive, more successful? What makes other firms less successful?
So let me ask you this. A recent paper found that a couple of Fortune 500 companies who switched from cubicles to an open office plan with the hopes of increasing employee collaboration, that in fact, the openness led to less collaboration. So knowing what you know about offices and people, does that surprise you?
Not really. You know, there's a huge problem with open offices in terms of collaboration, that you have no privacy. Whereas if it's in a slightly more closed environment, it's easier to discuss ideas, to bounce things around.
Or consider the ultimate closed environment, your own home.
One piece of research I did that connected very much to the open office was the benefits of working from home. So working from home has a terrible reputation amongst many people, you know, the nickname shirking from home. So I decided to do a scientific study. So we got a large online travel agency to ask a division who wanted to work from home, and we then had them randomize employees by even or odd birthdays into working at home versus working in the office.
Now, this was a travel agency in China, correct?
Yes, it was Ctrip, which is China's largest travel agency. It's very much like Expedia in the US. And stunningly, what came out as one of the biggest driving factors is it's just much quieter working from home. They complained so often about, you know, the amount of noise and disruption going on in the office. So they're all in an open office and they tell us about, you know, people's having boyfriend problems, there's a cake in the bakeout room, the World Cup sweepstake. I mean, the most amazing was the woman that told us about her cubicle neighbor who'd have endless conversations with her mum about her medical problems, including, you know, horrible things like her ingrowing toenail and some kind of wart issue. I mean, what could be more distracting than that? So not surprisingly, you know, in that case, open office was devastating for her productivity.
So you find that overall, working from home raises what exactly? Is it productivity? Is it happiness?
So we found working from home raises productivity by 13%, which is massive. That's almost like an extra day a week. So A, much more productive, I mean, massively more productive, way more than anyone predicted. And B, they seemed a lot happier. Their attrition rate, so how frequently they quit. Part of this was they didn't have the commute and all the uncertainty and they didn't have to take sick days off. But the other big driver is it's just so much quieter at home.
You also do write, though, that one of the downsides of working from home was promotion became less likely, yes?
Yes. We don't know why, but one argument's out of sight, out of mind. They just get forgotten about. Another story would be actually you need to develop skills of, you know, human capital and relationship capital. Therefore, you need to be in the office to get that to be promoted. And then the third reason I heard, you know, we talk to people working at home and they'd say, I don't want to be promoted because in order to be promoted, I need to come in the office more. So actually I'm happy where I am. You know what? It's not worth it.
I just want them to leave me alone.
I mean, the most surprising thing from the Ctrip working from home experiment was after the end of the 9 months, Ctrip was so happy. They were saving about $2,000 per employee working from home because they were more productive and they saved an office space. So they said, okay, everyone can now work from home. And we discovered of the people in the experiment, about 50% of them that had been at home decided to come back into the office. And that seemed like an amazing decision because A, they're now choosing to commute for something like 40 minutes each way a day. And also, since they're less productive in the office and about half their pay was bonus pay, they're getting paid less. So all in all, we calculated, you know, their time and pay was kind of falling by 10-15%, but they were still coming in. And the reason they told us is it was lonely at home. So people always joke, you know, the three great enemies of working from home is the fridge, the bed, and the television. And some people can handle that and others can't. And, you know, you don't really know till you've tried it. So what happens is people try it and some people love it and they're very productive. Great, they should stick with it. And others try it and they loathe it and they come back into the office.
The more you learn about the productivity and happiness of office workers in different settings, the more obvious it is that one key ingredient is often overlooked: choice. Some employees really might be better off at home. Others might prefer the cubicle, and some might thrive in an open office. You also have to acknowledge that no one environment will be ideal for every task.
So if you stop and think about how do we spend our time, about half of our time is spent in focus mode, which means we're working alone. A little over a quarter of our time is working with others in person, and about 20% is working with others virtually.
That's Janet Pogue McLaurin from the global design and architecture firm Gensler.
I'm one of our global workplace practice area leaders.
Given the diversity of tasks required of the modern office worker,
you need the best environment for the task at hand. So if you're getting ready to go on to a conference call, instead of taking at your desk, you may go into a conference room. When you finish that, you may go back to your desk to catch up on email. You may socialize around a cafe area or even take a walking meeting outside. We need to have all these other work settings at our disposal to be able to create a wonderful work experience.
That doesn't sound so hard, does it? So how do you create that? Let's start with the basics. Pogue McLaurin acknowledges that many open offices don't address their key shortcoming.
The biggest complaint that we see in open offices that don't work is the noise. And how do you mitigate noise, interruptions, and distractions? And that can be noise as well as visual. And so being able to design a space that zones the floor in smaller neighborhoods, that tries to get buffers between noisy activities. There's architectural interventions we can also do with ceilings and materials and white noise that may be added to the space. And it's not about creating too quiet of an environment. That can be just as ineffective as a noisy environment. You really want to have enough buzz and energy, but just not hear every word.
You also want to account for what economists call heterogeneous preferences and what normal people call individual choice.
Choice is one of the key drivers of effective workspace. And we have found that the most innovative firms actually offer twice as much choice and exercise on that choice than non-innovative firms do. And choice is really around autonomy about when and where to work. And it could be as simple as having a choice of being able to do focus work in the morning or being able to work at home a day or in another work setting in the office.
To that end, no two employees are exactly alike. And more important, no two companies are alike either.
I think some common mistakes that organizations do is they try to copy someone else's design. So if you think it's a cool idea of something that you saw on the West Coast, let's say it's a tech firm, and you're not even a tech firm, and you're sitting here on the East Coast, and you try to just copy it verbatim, it doesn't work. It's got to reflect how your organization works and the purpose and brand and community that you're a part of.
It's worth noting that Janet Pogue McLaurin, a principal with a design and architecture firm, is arguing that the key to a successful office is design and architecture. But it's also worth noting that her firm has done a great deal of research in all different kinds of offices, all different kinds of companies all over the world.
We've done several studies in the U.S. and the U.K., but we've also done Latin America, Asia, Middle East, and we're just completing a study in Germany.
So, what's her prognosis for the long maligned open office?
The open office is not dead. Oftentimes people say, you know, which is better, private office or open plan? We measured all types of individual work environments. And what we found is that if you solve for design, noise, and access to people and resources, they perform equally. And one is essentially not better than the other. And the best open plan can be as effective as a private one. And that was a surprise. I love data when it tells you something unexpected.
So do we, Janet Pogue McLaurin. So do we. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week, but if you can't wait that long, check out our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or on Stitcher. You can always get the most recent episodes or subscribe on any podcast app.